You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On February 2nd, Uber, the car on demand service, announced a strategic partnership with Carnegie Mellon University. It's believed they will partner to research and develop autonomous cars, joining other ventures already in the works by Google, Tesla, Toyota, Audi, and China. The car of the future is almost here, and it's going to revolutionize the global $3 trillion automobile industry. In a new book from Simon & Schuster called The Great Race, The Global Quest for the Car of the Future, Levi Tilghman of the New America Foundation explores the latest science and the impact it will have on how we move, work, and live. I'm very pleased that it brings Levi Tilghman to our show today. Hello.
Good to be here.
You begin your book with an anecdote about Henry Ford. Did he really build the first car, his first car anyway, inside a garage with a door too small to allow it to get out?
Yes, in fact, he did. And Henry Ford was such a methodical guy. It's kind of crazy to think that he would have spent months, almost a year, working on this car without realizing that he didn't have a way to get it out the door. But I kind of suspect that he might have known in advance that that was going to be a problem, because when he finished, he didn't waste any time. He grabbed an axe and he started hacking at the door frame, and then he knocked down the brick wall without telling the individual that he had rented the garage from that he was going to do it. At the end of the day, the guy wasn't that angry. He was really excited to see Ford's new car.
In those days, there were all different kinds of proposals for how to power the cars. Petroleum was one of them, but there was already talk about batteries. There was the Stanley Steamer.
There were many different kinds of cars. In fact, for a while, there were more electric cars on the road than there were internal combustion engine vehicles. And Thomas Edison spent more than $1 million of his own money researching electric batteries for cars specifically. If you change that to the money of today, it would be somewhere close to $30 million. So big people were invested in EVs from the beginning.
And why, if battery research was done so early, has it taken so long? Did we just abandon them?
Well, the number one reason is that oil has an incredible property, which is it's extremely energy dense. That means you can fit a lot of energy in a very, very small space. And batteries don't do that nearly as well. Even today, with the much more advanced lithium ion chemistries that we're using in today's electric vehicles, you just get a lot more energy in a given volume and for a given weight in oil than you can in a battery.
So is that the problem that has to be overcome if we want to move to electric?
It's one of the problems.
How are people thinking that they can overcome that?
I think the bigger problem today is a problem of cost and also a problem of infrastructure. Now, I do want to say that people tend to think of electric cars as expensive, but the truth of the matter is they are not that expensive. The average vehicle sold in the U.S. last year was about $32,000. The average electric car, or not the average electric car, but the Nissan Leaf, which is the best sold electric vehicle, sells at below $30,000. It's only $29,000. And then you have added tax incentives from the federal government and state and sometimes local governments that really bring those prices down to very affordable levels.
The bigger problems seem to be infrastructure, recharging it, the idea that the charge doesn't last all that long. In a city like New York, where most people don't have garages, it would be really hard to plug in a car. So how do you overcome all of those things?
You hit the nail on the head. Urban charging is, I think, one of the biggest issues facing electric vehicles.
And it would
now
seem to me that electric cars are ideal for an urban situation a lot more than for a rural one.
They're a terrific solution for cities, provided we can figure out a good way to charge them. And there are a number of different initiatives going forward on that front now. California's experimenting with some interesting infrastructure proposals. New York actually was one of the first states in the country to pass a law that said that new parking facilities have to be at least ducted for 20% EV charging. And that means you don't necessarily have to install the chargers themselves, because those are quite expensive, and you're probably not going to be able to fill your garage with 20% electric vehicles today. But you can put in the piping that allows you to very quickly install that charging very cheaply once you make the decision to put the chargers in.
Wasn't your interest in this topic inspired by working with your father on a new, cleaner internal combustion engine?
It certainly was. Me and my father had a startup company called Iris Engines. We were working on a design for a more powerful, more compact, and substantially more efficient internal combustion engine. And one day I walked into the office of the head of product planning for the Ford Motor Company. He watched my presentation. I was trying to pitch him the design and get him to invest in our company. And when it was done, he said, "It's a great design, very interesting intellectual property, but I'm not going to put money into it." And the reason why is that we have a very efficient, powerful little EcoBoost engine we're going to use for the next 15 years or so. And after that, everything is going towards electric vehicles. And so I'm not going to spend the $1, $2 billion it would take to develop a new internal combustion engine when the entire industry is going electric.
And that was how many years ago? This is 2007 when you went to Ford?
This was in the winter of 2009. Mm-hmm.
They already had a roadmap for how they were going to develop. Well, but they'd had electric cars before. There was that whole electric car thing that happened in California. Certain people were allowed to have them, and they loved the car. And then they were all gathered up and destroyed. What happened there?
California is a huge part of this story. And the reason California has played such a critical role is that they latched onto the concept of the electric car as means of reducing air pollution.
Because Los Angeles at one point was really scary to travel in.
Exactly. It was horrible. I mean, it was almost reminiscent of the air pollution in Beijing or Shanghai today. And so GM had been experimenting with some electric vehicle technology. And the regulators at an institution called the California Air Resource Board, which has the authority to mandate certain emissions technologies on cars and other kinds of facilities as well, saw this car that GM was working on, and they said, "This is the perfect solution to California's air pollution problems." And they followed that up with a regulation called their ZEV regulation, Zero Emissions Vehicle Regulation, which basically said that automakers, if they wanted to sell cars in California, had to sell a certain percentage of those vehicles as electric vehicles. Now, over the next decade, there were a lot of lawsuits, there was a lot of push and pull between the regulators and the industry, and eventually that program became mired in a whole host of issues, and it slowed down by the beginning of the first 2000s, but then it kicked right back up again in the mid-2000s, and California is still really driving this market today.
But I remember seeing a documentary in which those cars seemed to be very popular, seemed to have overcome all the things we're discussing today, or maybe they didn't, but the drivers seemed to like them. And then it posited a conspiracy by the petroleum industry that ended it. Now, that probably isn't the way things really were, but a lot of people liked that film.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the film. I'm also a big fan of electric cars. I do think that they went a little bit far when they were positing that there was this conspiracy to kill the electric vehicle.
Why did Ford recall them all and then just have them crushed?
There are a lot of reasonable reasons why you would want to do that. For one, this was new technology, and the people at the automotive companies didn't know what was going to happen with it when it was on the road 5-10 years longer. And so from a simple liability standpoint, it made a lot more sense for them to recall these vehicles and to dispose of them than to let kind of an untested technology float around there on the streets.
My guest is Levi Tilleman, T-I-L-L-E-M-A-N-N. His book, The Great Race, The Global Quest for the Car of the Future. Let's get back to the engine that you and your father were developing. What were you trying to do there?
Well, we were really trying to remake the global auto industry. And that meeting that I talked to you about with Derek Kuzak from Ford, you know, it was a huge shock to me because I had spent the last 18 months telling people why batteries were not the solution. I knew all the problems with batteries. And then I went and I sat in this meeting with Kuzak, and he said with a straight face, "Everything's going electric." And I wanted to understand why that was the case. And what I found is that there was a long-range strategic policy being carried out by the California Air Resource Board to force automakers throughout the entire United States and eventually World to develop and sell these electric cars.
But you had come up with a cleaner internal combustion engine. Was it really efficient? Because it came to a very sad end.
Well, we were very early stage, and the meeting that we were discussing happened actually 18 months after my father had passed away in a car accident.
The car that you had developed was a Dodge Caravan that had the new engine, careened over the side of a mountain, and the engine exploded.
Well, actually, the engine wasn't in that vehicle. This was just a standard Dodge Caravan minivan, and there was a malfunction with the car, and it ended up going off the side of a big embankment, and my father passed away as a result of the crash.
You had been given research money. FedEx gave you some, and others. In hopes of having a more efficient engine for their trucks?
Not quite. We had a meeting with Fred Smith, who is the CEO of FedEx, and we had a number of discussions with him where he expressed interest in investing in our technology. And he was actually a great guy. He said to us, "I think this is compelling. I'm a patriot. I think we should be getting off of foreign oil, and this is a good solution to get there. And so what I'll do is I will introduce you to my friends in the auto industry, including people like Alan Mulally, who is the CEO of Ford, the head of Penske, the head of Cummins, which are all big auto companies. And Smith told us that if they would fund half of our development budget, which was, big, it was $14 million, then he would fund the other half of the development budget. The industry is notoriously conservative, but for good reason. They have a lot of variables to worry about, and the last thing they want to worry about is an unproven technology. And that ended up not happening, but we did have a great relationship with FedEx for a while.
But after you realized there was no future for Iris Engines, you closed down the company and then studied Chinese and Japanese. Why?
Well, this was all part of my quest to understand why the people at Ford were so certain that the whole industry was going electric. And to do that, I wanted to look at the different regulatory systems for vehicles around the world and something called industrial policy. Basically, the effort by countries to promote specific technologies in the automotive market. And I looked at the three largest economies in the world, three largest auto markets in the world, China, Japan, and the United States. And as I was studying them, I realized that there was a fourth actor that really had to be added into that equation, which was California. And the funny thing about California is it is much smaller from an economic perspective or from a population perspective, and certainly in terms of auto sales, than those other three entities that I mentioned. But because they're very strategic and they're very clever in their policy design, they're the ones who are really setting the technology agenda for the entire world.
We're talking about Silicon Valley.
Not Silicon Valley. I'm talking about a group of regulators called the California Air Resource Board that has a special carve-out as a result of the 1970 Clean Air Act that allows them to set their own regulations for emissions. And other states are allowed to follow one of two sets of emissions regulations. The first is federal emission regulations, and the second is California emission regulations. And about 20%, 25% of the U.S. auto market follows these California regulations, which gives the California Air Resource Board a huge amount of power over the U.S. and therefore the global auto industry.
Although I remember when the United States decided to issue some standards, there was a huge outcry from the industry. Why, if 20% of this, how many states, 20 states,
so
are already following the California approach?
It's California plus seven other states. And if you add them all together, then their cumulative market share is about 25% for U.S. automotive sales and the U.S. economy.
Levi Tilleman's book is called The Great Race, The Global Quest for the Car of the Future. It is published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue. We'll go to Shanghai after we take a little break. We are back with Levi Tilleman, who is the Cal and Jeff Leonard Fellow at the New America Foundation. He served as a special advisor for policy and international affairs for the U.S. Department of Energy, and as we have been discussing earlier, was CEO and co-founder of Iris Engines, a company to develop a smaller, more efficient, and more powerful combustion engine. He's written a book called The Great Race, The Global Quest for the Car of the Future. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Before we get into what people are actually developing, let's follow up a bit more on what's happening in California. The regulations will determine to some degree what these cars look like?
Certainly. So California decided that if they wanted to keep their air quality that was, you know, really a hard-fought gain through the 1960s and 70s, that they would have to move from today's internal combustion engine vehicles, which are really quite low emission, to zero emission vehicles. And the way that they decided to do that was to tell automakers that in certain target years, a certain percentage of their vehicles had to be zero emission vehicles. Now, they did something really cool, though, which is they kind of overlaid a market on top of what was really sort of a draconian mandate. And that meant that when you sold an electric car in California, if you're an automaker, you got a credit, a zero emissions vehicle credit. And you could either keep that credit for your own compliance purposes, or you could sell it to another automaker, which meant that companies like Tesla and Nissan that got out in front on this technology and sold a lot of electric vehicles early could make a lot of money by selling these credits to other automakers that were less aggressive. So Tesla, for instance, earned about $76 million in the third quarter of 2014 just by selling these credits.
Now, gas emissions are down, but that's partly because gas prices went up and people stopped buying SUVs in the numbers they had in the past. When prices went down more recently, there was discussion about the possibility that larger cars would once again become popular. That's the other side of this story.
It's true. There are two different kinds of emissions. One kind is what's called criteria emissions, and those are things like lead and sulfur dioxide that are really bad for human health. They cause cancer.
Aren't they taken out of petroleum these days?
So in general, cars have done a pretty good job in eliminating those kinds of criteria emissions. There's still a problem, but not nearly the problem they were in the 1960s and 1970s. The other kind of emissions, though, is called greenhouse gas emissions, and those are the emissions that contribute to global warming. Those emissions are reduced when you increase fuel efficiency, but they're reduced much more so if you can transition to a technology like electric vehicles that perhaps gets its electricity from solar power or wind power, and that means that you really can have the prospect of almost eliminating greenhouse gas emissions as well.
So instead of having batteries, we would have cars that would have electric power driving them?
Well,
the whole body of the car would be collecting sunlight?
No, I think what I'm talking about is you put a solar panel on top of your house. You have a car that's...
But I did hear somebody was actually thinking of doing something like that.
Ford actually had a pretty cool concept car last year at the Washington, D.C. Auto Show that had a solar panel that was integrated into the roof. And I forget exactly the number, but I think they thought that you could get maybe 20 miles of range a day off of that if the car was allowed to autonomously position itself to get maximum sunlight all day long, which is kind of cool.
And you didn't live in Seattle or Portland.
Exactly, exactly.
In your first chapter, you explain the importance of the Shanghai World Expo and one man in particular, Wang Gang. Who is he and how did he reveal a new China to the rest of the world?
Wang Gang is China's Minister of Science and Technology. And he has a fascinating background. He, unlike most members of the State Council who are the ministers and the leaders of the People's Republic of China, Wang Gang is not a member of the Communist Party. And he was picked for this very high-level position in the Chinese government because he had a vision of China leapfrogging the West, Japan, the United States and Europe in automotive technology.
China has been mostly an importer of cars until now.
Well, China has the world's largest auto manufacturing sector, but what they have imported is the technology. Most of the technology that's used to build Chinese cars comes from the West in various forms.
Well, Japan, I assume.
Yeah, Japan, which I guess you could...
Well, how did joining the World Trade Organization change the landscape for China and... its decision to leapfrog and make these new cars?
Before the World Trade Organization, China had a very insulated automobile market that had very high prices and very low quality. And when China joined the WTO, that put a huge amount of competitive pressure on its domestic automakers to reduce their prices, to increase their quality. And what you saw almost immediately was a massive surge in auto sales in China. In the year 2000, China manufactured fewer cars than Spain. And today, China manufactures about 23 million vehicles a year, which makes it by far the largest auto manufacturer in the world.
Hasn't it also entered into joint agreements with other manufacturers? General Motors, for example, with Shanghai Automotive Industrial Corporation?
Yes. So you talked about the World Expo. And the thing that really impressed me at the World Expo was this pavilion that General Motors put together with the Shanghai Automotive Industrial Corporation, which is one of the largest auto manufacturers in China and their GM's Chinese manufacturing partner. You walked into this expo pavilion and you sat down in a seat. You strapped into a five-point harness. There was an IMAX screen in front of you, and they had created this movie that it was really a ride. It was kind of like a Disneyland or Disney World ride, and it flew you through this vision of what Shanghai could look like in 2030. And the skies were clean. All the cars drove themselves. They were all electric. There weren't even stoplights. You know, if you were blind, you could drive. There was a compelling vision there that in 2010 seemed pretty far out. But today, it actually seems pretty attainable.
And when are they saying this is likely to happen?
We are already seeing the early stages of vehicle autonomy or cars that drive themselves today. So, for instance, the new Tesla has a variety of low-level autonomous features. But if you look at big Tier 1 automotive suppliers like Bosch, they have a very clear roadmap for introducing increased levels of automation in their supply chain starting in the year 2020. By 2025, Bosch is looking at selling systems that will enable, you know, essentially an entirely autonomous vehicle, a car that can drive itself.
And I'm wondering what that means. Well, first, let me tell people that my guest is Levi Tilghman. His book is called The Great Race, The Global Quest for the Car of the Future, published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When I've spoken to friends about the possibility of a car that drives itself, none of them seem to think that's something they would want to be in. They're not sure they trust it. Some of them say, look, I'm still resisting having an automatic, let alone that. And how would the car find a parking spot in Brooklyn? It's hard enough for a driver who can see ahead to spot one. How is a car going to do it and then know that the space is big enough?
We are witnessing a once-in-a-lifetime transformation from cars that drive on oil and that we drive ourselves to cars that will drive on clean electricity and will drive themselves. And the nice thing is that theoretically, these cars that drive themselves should be much safer. They shouldn't have to worry about things like parking because a lot of them will be shared. So you won't necessarily own a car. It will be a service like Uber, where you press a button, you ask the car to come pick you up, it drops you off where you're going, and then it goes to pick up the next passenger. And
it's kind of like the bike things that we have in New York.
Exactly. And it should be able to take care of a lot of the issues that we associate with automotive culture today. You know, traffic, pollution, you know, traffic deaths, all of these things should be able to be dramatically reduced by the advent of autonomous vehicles.
Is this being driven mostly by private industry? How much have governments got involved?
Electrification is mostly driven by government regulations. Now, automakers realize that
are governments investing in them? The United States is not. In fact, I'd imagine if you went to this current Congress and said, put some money into developing a self-driving car, you'd hear just howls of derision.
Well, self-driving cars are one thing, and electric vehicles are something else. They will come together in the future, but self-driving cars are really the initiative of private industry, and especially companies like Google that recognized the groundwork that had been laid through various government R&D efforts, and they said, this is a way that we can get into the automotive industry and really shake things up.
It's been my sense that the Japanese have been at the forefront here. Toyota, for example. What have they been doing that American car manufacturers have not been doing?
Toyota is an interesting company because they are the best company in the world at much of what they do. But they're also a very conservative company, and they really don't like to get out in front of technology trends. And so if you talk to a representative from Toyota about autonomous vehicles, they will give you a very measured answer that will say, well, you know, we don't really see cars becoming fully autonomous. We see cars having certain autonomous capabilities. Now, if you contrast that to what the people at Google say, it's a totally different story. The people at Google say cars will drive themselves, and they are actually building prototype cars that don't have steering wheels.
Haven't the Japanese invested heavily in R&D in California?
Yes. I mean, California is a huge
market. So they're not that conservative. Sellers. They just don't want to do it themselves.
The philosophy of most Japanese companies has been, especially Toyota, has been, if you regulate it, we will build it. But we're not going to get out in front of those regulations. At the same time, we're not going to fight you like Detroit does.
Last September, America's most successful electric vehicle manufacturer announced plans to build a massive battery factory in the United States. Where's the plant? Who's behind it? And do you see that as part of the future?
This is Tesla Motors' Gigafactory. Mm-hmm. And it is such an interesting project in so many ways. One thing that I find very interesting about it is that Tesla's building it, but they're building it in partnership with Panasonic. Tesla realizes that they don't have the technical know-how to build a high-quality battery manufacturing plant. And so what they've done is they've invited in their Japanese partners, who they already procure their lithium-ion batteries from, and they're working on this together. The second thing that is really fascinating and compelling about the Gigafactory project is just the scale. They are doubling the amount of lithium-ion battery manufacturing capacity in the world. The entire global manufacturing capacity of lithium-ion batteries in 2013 is the same size as Tesla's Gigafactory will be in 2020.
And what are they projecting? How long would the battery hold to charge?
Well,
because that's the biggest problem. If we were talking about driving within the city, okay, so you have a drive that lasts up to an hour. But if I decide that I want to go to the Poconos, will I be able to do it on single charge?
It really depends on how many batteries you put in the car. So Tesla
batteries
sells,
are heavy, aren't they?
They're heavy, but you know, they also can add to performance if you situate them appropriately in the vehicle. One thing that makes the Tesla Model S such a great performer is it has this big, flat, heavy battery pack sitting in the bottom of the vehicle. And that means that it grabs the road like, you know, like it's a track.
So some people like heavier cars. These are heavier cars that won't have the kinds of gas emissions that heavy cars in the past have had.
The interesting thing about the Tesla Model S is that it has the safety of a Volvo. It can seat 7 people, so the seating capacity of a minivan. It has the performance of a supercar, and it has the environmental impact, you know, at least when you're talking about energy use, of a Prius or less. So it's quite a package.
On the other hand, it's very expensive.
On the other hand, it's very expensive.
$100,000 and up?
$70,000 and up. And it actually takes a fair amount of CO2 to manufacture those batteries. And so people have to look at those processes and figure out how you can drive down the environmental impact of manufacturing these vehicles, how you can drive down the CO2 emissions from the electrical grid in the long term. But electric vehicles are the only real option that we have to get to a zero oil, zero emissions future.
What about the environmental impact of the spent batteries?
The thesis that people have today is that those batteries are going to be taken from electric vehicles when they're about at 80% of capacity and used for storing renewable energy. The problem with renewable energy is that it's intermittent. You know, it has a lot of good things about it. For instance, that it doesn't cost anything to produce renewable energy once you have deployed that solar cell or that wind farm. But the bad thing about renewable energy is, you know, for wind, it only is produced when the wind blows. Or for solar energy, it's only produced when the sun shines. And so you need somewhere to store that energy when the wind isn't blowing or when the sun isn't shining. And electric vehicle batteries are a great option for that.
So what do you see in the future? A situation where all cars are running on some kind of electricity, or we'll have a mix of that and hybrids and also some cars that are low emission petroleum cars?
There are going to be a variety of different cars going into the future. And the rate of growth for each kind of car is going to have a lot to do with policy. So we'll have fuel cell vehicles, we'll have electric vehicles, we'll have hybrid electric vehicles, and we'll have gasoline combustion engines. But policymakers are going to make a lot of the decisions that tell us how much of what kind of vehicle we're going to have how soon.
One of my producers still wants to have a manual transmission in his car. Is he going to be disappointed in the near future?
I like manual transmissions too. I ride a motorcycle, and you know they're a lot of fun. But let me assure you, electric vehicles can have fantastic performance.
Hmm. But you don't have the whole thing with the clutch. Levi Tilleman's book is called The Great Race, The Global Quest for the Car of the Future. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thanks for having me.